had allied with Zionists, why didn't the Nazi Party survive? Well, what happened was, in 1945, after the German military was defeated, they brought in the German leaders, the German generals, at the Nuremberg trials, tried and convicted and executed them. They had to execute them because they didn't want them around to testify that the about the alliance between the Nazis and the Zionists. So they had to die, and they were executed for that reason. Because, oh, they told about the atrocities that the German generals had committed. But German generals are like any other generals. They don't really commit atrocities. The troops under their command may commit atrocities, but they don't commit any atrocities themselves. These German generals didn't go around shooting Jews or anybody else. But they were executed, and so the Zionist secret was safe. That and now the Zionists were now in command of the world, because their National Socialist allies were now gone from history, and the Zionists had a free reign, so they set up the State of Israel. And in fact, some Jews themselves even claim that there should be a statue to Adolf Hitler in Israel, because he created the State of Israel, which is absolutely true. Without Adolf Hitler, Israel would not exist. The Jews would still be dispersed, and they would have no country. But George Steiner, a very famous Jewish writer, proposed this about 10 years ago. He said, why don't they put up a statue to Adolf Hitler in Israel? Well, they're not likely to. And because there again, the big job of the criminals is to keep the truth from the people. They want, not only do they want you not to find out anything, but they flood you with disinformation. Most of the stuff that you get in the press is absolute lies. And if it's not lies, it's spin or distortions. In other words, they give you 10% of the truth, and the rest is all distortions. And they demonize people so that you're filled with anger against the Holocaust people who murdered all the Jews in Germany. And people do get very angry because of these things, and they don't even know what they're angry about because they're not told the facts, and never will be told the facts, because the press is totally in the hands of the bankers, because news is a high-budget, capital-intensive operation. You need a lot of money. You need a staff covering the whole world, and it's a very expensive situation. So the average truth seeker is not going to start his own television station or newspaper, because he doesn't have the $100 million that you need to even get it off the ground. So we're reduced to meetings like this, which are very good. And we also, God apparently was merciful on us, and he gave us the internet. In fact, in the States, we had this total monopoly of television by three television networks, which were all controlled by Zionists. And so along came cable, and suddenly we had all new stations and all sorts of controversial programs coming on, which of course the three Zionist networks would not touch with a 10-foot pole. And the result was they were left behind. They had 100% of the television audience. They now have 30%, and it's dropping every year. In fact, it's probably less than 30%, but they're cooking the books in order to maintain their advertising revenues to give a totally false picture of their audience, which is probably less than half of what they claim, because that's how they keep up their television revenues, based on audience share. So this is all a banker's operation, and I was telling you about the fact that the bankers met in Jekyll Island in 1910, and who was the chairman of this meeting? The chairman of this secret meeting was Senator Nelson Aldrich, the Republican majority leader of the Senate. And, of course, the Republican Party was in full power at that time, because after the Civil War, the corporations and banks moved in and took over everything. And they made money so fast that they didn't know what to do with it. And they owned all the railroads and the corporations, and the profits rolled in. And, in fact, they were making so much money that they decided, look, we've got to protect our gains. We don't want any competition. So these corporations passed the Sherman Antitrust Act, which said you cannot compete with the big corporations. Now, they sold this to Congress. They said, look, we want to have free competition. We don't want any restraint of trade. So we're going to pass the Antitrust Act so there will be no more big trusts in the United States. Everything will be open to everybody. Anybody could start a company and do whatever they want. But actually, the Sherman Antitrust Act in operation has always been to stifle competition. That these upstart companies, like Bill Gates comes along with Microsoft, and that's why the Justice Department went after him, because this was the true spirit of antitrust, was for the Justice Department to crush Bill Gates, and the lawsuit was brought by his own competitors. They said, Bill Gates has too much of the business. So that's a sin. And of course, the Justice Department is against sin, so they went after Bill Gates. And even though he was the richest man in the world, when the Justice Department went after him, because they could fold him up like a collapsing door because they have so much power, and the Sherman Antitrust Act and all that stuff. But what they were trying to do was send Bill Gates a message, you're now the richest man in the world, and you're spending $1.5 million a year in Washington? This is ridiculous. So he got the message, and he's now spending about $50 million a year. And because the criminals, they want you to share. If you're making a lot of money, they want you to share it with them. Just be nice. Don't be selfish. And so that's the whole story of the Justice Department. They want you to be nice. And they do it through taxation, and they do it through government force, if that's necessary, and that's what they did. So this is the whole system which was set up in 1694 in England. And what happened was in 1688, England had what they called the Glorious Revolution. And this is part of English history, the Glorious Revolution. What was the Glorious Revolution? The Amsterdam bankers, who at that time were the richest people in the world, they controlled most of banking in the world, they were very unhappy with King James II of England. They were afraid that his daughter, who had married a Catholic, they were going to have a Catholic king of England, and they didn't want this, because they didn't want... See, Henry VIII had rebelled against the Catholics and taken away all their lands and created a whole new dukedom, which of the people he gave the Catholic lands to. So England had been Protestant after that time. So James II, they thought, my gosh, he's going to go back to a Catholic. So the Amsterdam bankers decided, they had a minor prince in the Netherlands called William. So they decided to finance William, who had a claim to the English throne, a very small claim. They would finance him to invade England and take it over. Well, the problem was William did not have many troops or many ships. He had by no means any amount of military force which he could take over England. So they did it the easy way. They bribed all of King James's admirals and generals to sell him out. And when King William's little flotilla appeared off the coast of England, all of King James's generals and admirals defected to William. So he almost won England without firing a shot. And the purpose of all this was they wanted to set up a central bank in England. So King William set up the Bank of England in 1694. And up to that time, England had about every 50 years they'd have a revolution or a war. After the Bank of England was set up, there has never been a revolution in England, because for a revolution, you need some money. And once the Bank of England took over the finances of the British Empire, nobody ever had any money to object to anything. And so England has enjoyed tranquility for 300 years. It's that simple. Control the money and you control the people. So the bankers realized they needed intelligence. So they set up the first and best intelligence operation in the world called the British Secret Information Service, SIS. And the purpose of the SIS was not merely to gather intelligence, but also to control the opposition. So if there was any opposition, these intelligence operators would infiltrate it and take it over. This is laid out by a Chinese general named Sun Tzu, who said, always control the opposition. Doesn't matter what it is. It can be the Thursday morning garden club or whatever, but you send agents in and you control it. And in fact, I was very active in right-wing organizations all through the 50s and 60s, and we could always tell a government informant because he would come in and make the biggest donation. And then he would say, look, you guys are not doing anything. Let's get something going here. Let's blow up a building. I'll get the dynamite. It won't cost you a penny, and we'll take care of everything. And these guys would say, hey, this is good. We'll really get something going. So they'd blow up a building, and then they'd all go to prison for life. because they would have so much testimony against them. When they went to court, they didn't have a chance. And, of course, their lawyers would never plead entrapment or anything like that. And so these guys were on the fast track to 30 years in prison. And this is controlling the opposition, and that's how it's done. So the result is there's very little opposition because it's all infiltrated. And you can always tell the government informant because he is the real activist. And he is the one that brings in the money. If you can't pay the rent on the hall, he pays the rent. You know, this guy is a real patriot, you know. So, so I saw this from the inside for over 30 years. But my work was mostly intellectual, so I wasn't too involved in any of this. But I did make a speech in Coeur d'Alene and Idaho. And I said, I know you Idaho people are great hunters. And I said, you like to hunt bighorn sheep and you like to hunt cougars and so forth. But I said, I think you're missing a bet. I said, I think that the most thrilling sport of all is hunting federal agents. Well, 2 days later, the Murrow Building blows up. And I never heard a word from anybody to this day. But the Spokane paper did a front page story on me and what I had said, you know. And I thought, well, by gosh, now they're going to say that I blew up the Murrow Building. Well, nobody to this day ever said anything. And I was quoted in the New York Times as saying it's a standard government operation, which of course it was. And I had a friend named Red Beckman in Montana. He was quoted on the front page of the Wall Street Journal that this was a standard government operation, which of course it was, because I know the whole patriot movement in the United States, and I have never met anybody who would want to blow up the Murrow Building. I mean, to them, it would be totally counterproductive. Now, if they really wanted to blow up something, they would blow up something in Washington, but they didn't. They went to Heartland America out in Oklahoma, where none of the bureaucrats in Washington would be bruised by the bomb going off, and blew it up there. And the people in Oklahoma, of course, shed tears. And the government rushed in and leveled the entire building and destroyed all the evidence. And then they convicted Timothy McVeigh of killing 168 people with no evidence because they had destroyed the evidence. How you convict somebody after destroying all the evidence, I don't know, but they did. And McVeigh, of course, was a patsy like Lee Harvey Oswald and the Kennedy assassination, that sort of thing. Because there are always these drifters around and you can pick them up and do anything you want to with them. They're considered throwaways anyway, so nobody cares what happens to them. And I don't know what's ever going to happen to Timothy McVeigh. I seriously doubt that he will ever be executed. I think they'll just let the American people forget about him and go on. But anyway, to get back to Jekyll Island in 1910, Senator Nelson Aldrich, the chairman of this meeting, was the father-in-law of John D. Rockefeller, Jr. Now, what had happened with John D. Rockefeller, who was financed by the Rothschilds, by the way, so it was really a Rothschild operation. We're trained to think of the Rockefellers as terrible bandits and unscrupulous oligarchs and so forth. Well, in fact, they're nobodies. The Rockefellers are nobody today in this country, but they're a convenient whipping boy. So Rockefeller, after the Rothschilds set him up to be the biggest monopoly in the world, Standard Oil of New Jersey, they looked around for other fields, and so they put him into the medical profession. He revolutionized the medical profession in this country, converted it almost overnight from homeopathy and naturopathy to allopathic medicine. Allopathic medicine, which I describe in my book, Murder by Injection, was a German system which relied on radical surgery, lengthy hospital stays, and heavy use of drugs, When I say drugs, I mean drugs. And so they put the medical profession into the drug business. And that was a Rockefeller operation. Then they decided to use Rockefeller to create their central bank and money monopoly. So they set up a National Monetary Commission. In 1907, the bankers in New York precipitated a panic of 1907. And people lost their money and banks closed and there was economic chaos. And so obviously, then the bankers set up a public hue and cry for banking reform. You can read about it in the New York Times of that period. That they said, we must have banking reform. Well, of course, all of the devastation and depredation was caused by the bankers themselves. I mean, these people who put the money in these banks did not cause the banks to fail, and they didn't want to lose their money, but they lost their money. So, banking reform. So, Theodore Roosevelt set up the National Monetary Commission. And the National Monetary Commission was empowered to make recommendations for banking reform. So, the members of this commission, who of course were congressmen, under Nelson Aldrich, the Republican majority leader, they traveled to Europe. They wanted to see how banks worked in Europe. So they were wined and dined by the Rothschilds in Paris and London, and they had a great time for about 2 years, but they did absolutely nothing. And so people sort of forgot about banking reform. And after they had lulled the people into a total false sense of security, then they took off and went to Jekyll Island, to the Millionaires Club, and secretly drafted their central bank plan, which they called the Aldrich Plan after Nelson Aldrich. Well, of course, the Republicans adopted the Aldrich Plan as their platform in 1912. And the banker-controlled press set up a great hue and cry against the Aldrich Plan, as the Wall Street Plan, as the big banker's plan. Then they called on Woodrow Wilson, the Democratic candidate, to offer a better plan. So Woodrow Wilson put in the Democratic platform in 1912 the Federal Reserve Plan, which he offered as the alternative to the Aldrich Plan. Now, the interesting thing was it was exactly the same as the Aldrich Plan. But nobody noticed. And so, but they couldn't elect Woodrow Wilson because he was not a very charismatic person. He was a dull professor. He was not a good speaker. He was totally unlikable. So he was born in my hometown, by the way, Stanton, Virginia. That's its only, the only claim to fame in Stanton is that I'm from there and Woodrow Wilson was there. Nobody else ever ever amounted to anything. So so they had this task of electing Woodrow Wilson in order to enact the Federal Reserve Act. But unfortunately, William Howard Taft was very well-liked. He was the president running for re-election. And there was general prosperity. I mean, there was no reason for the American people to trade Taft for Woodrow Wilson. So the bankers called on an old friend, Theodore Roosevelt, who had set up the National Monetary Commission, and said, Ted, we need you to go in and splinter the Republican vote. So, Ted Roosevelt comes out of nowhere, starts the Bull Moose Party, runs for president himself, splits the Republican vote. Woodrow Wilson is a shoo-in, and Taft and Roosevelt, of course, disappear. So now they could have him sign the Federal Reserve Act. But the congressmen from the Middle West and the Far West were totally opposed to even the Federal Reserve Act, because they knew it was a phony. And so they were led by Congressman Charles Augustus Lindbergh of Minnesota. And I've been to his home in Little Falls, Minnesota, and it's a wonderful museum. This man really gave his life to fight the bankers. And, of course, he was the father of the aviator. And Lindbergh led the campaign against the Federal Reserve Act. And so Paul Warburg himself, who was the author of the act, and the other bankers had to, for the first time in their life, come down to Washington and lobby in the halls of Congress to get the Federal Reserve Act passed. And of course, they had to make a lot of promises, a lot of commitments, a lot of bribes. But since they printed the money, it didn't matter. So So they bribed the Congress to enact the Federal Reserve Act, which was signed, but they still could not get a majority vote. So they had to wait till the Christmas vacation after Lindbergh and the Middle Western and Western congressmen had departed for Christmas vacation. Then they brought the Federal Reserve Act before Congress on December 23rd after the opposition had left. But they still had a quorum. They still could pass it. And so even the New York Times said, never has legislation of such importance been passed under such circumstances. In other words, the whole Federal Reserve Act was passed through fraud. It was passed more or less while Congress was in Christmas vacation. And Wilson signed the act into law on December 23rd, practically Christmas Eve, and it became public law. So now that they had a central bank with the power to print all the money they wanted, a privately owned bank, and the Federal Reserve Act itself is an amazing act. It's an act of total monopoly because every word in it, first of all the money that the bankers can print becomes an obligation of the U.S. government, which means the U.S. taxpayer. Second, the stockholders of this private bank included in the legislation that no Federal Reserve Bank stock could ever be bought or sold on any exchange in the world. So in other words, the initial purchasers would own it in perpetuity, which is what happened because the Rothschilds, Warburgs, and Schiffs all bought the original stock in 1914 and have owned it ever since. And they've put it into foundations so it can never be touched. And these foundations are the real government of the United States, Rockefeller Foundation. Nearly all of your major legislation in the United States is prepared by these foundations. And they submit it to Congress, and of course they have enormous staffs and billions of dollars. So they bring the legislation before Congress. And it's impeccable. It's researched and it's phrased and everything is done just right. And so of course the Congress accepts it. And they look around, they say, is anybody objected to any of this? And of course, there's total silence. Nobody objects. So it becomes law. That's why you have laws constantly passed by Congress, which are actively opposed by 85% of the American people. Almost everything that's done in Washington is opposed by 85% of the American people. So you have government by 15%, government by elites. And they're not even Americans. These are international elitists. They have no allegiance whatsoever to the United States, just like your Canadian legislatures have no allegiance to you, they have no allegiance to Canada, they're part of the international elite. But of course they don't say this publicly, and the press hails them all as great patriots and dedicated people, selfless individuals. They love that word, selfless. Imagine, all your legislators are selfless. They never have a selfish bone in their body, because they're working for you. They want to give you things. And, of course, the only purpose they have is to rob you. Not only you, but all 6 billion people in the world. Because it's a government of robbery. So you have what you call the new economy in the United States, and probably Canada, too. And the new economy is simply people working and creating and producing in spite of everything the robbers can do to them. Everything that's accomplished in this country is accomplished in spite of the foundations, in spite of the bankers. People have to work harder to pay the interest, but they do that. They rise to the challenge, and so they've created a new economy, an economy of enormous prosperity. And the bankers don't like it, because the most influential financial reporter on television in the States is Louis Rukeyser, a Wall Street Week, which is a very honored program, been on for many years. So a couple of months ago, I was watching Wall Street Week, and Louis Rukeyser had some Wall Street people on. And so he said, well, what do you think about what's going on? That the stock market was dropping, you know. In fact, my stocks were dropping $10,000 a week. Just week after week, I was watching my little nest egg dwindle away, you know. And but I knew what was going on, and I couldn't do anything about it. I may eventually sue Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, for robbing me, because he robbed me. I mean, I saw $170,000 in stock vanish into thin air. And the stocks themselves were perfectly good. Every one of these companies was actually doing well. The economy was doing well. And Clinton, of course, was busy in the Oval Office. I mean, he wasn't interfering with any of this, you see. They said, listen, Bill, if you'll stay out of your way, you can have all the interns you want. And it sounded good to him, and so that's what he did. No, Clinton is the invisible president, believe it or not. He has absolutely no political influence whatsoever. And he has a crew in Washington. There was an FBI agent named Gary Aldrich who was stationed there. He was there during the Bush administration, which was a very staid and proper, even stuffy administration. Then in come the Clintons, a bunch of left-wing loonies, homosexuals, and these people were right out of the 1960s. They were absolute nuts, dope addicts, you name it. None of them could pass a clearance. Most of the Clinton White House staff has never been approved by the FBI. They have no security clearance. They should be arrested when they come to work. So Gary Aldrich wrote a best-selling book about this, he told how Hillary, when Christmas came, Hillary was decorating the Christmas trees with penises and condoms and so forth. And I mean, these people believe in what they're doing. They are the real revolutionaries because they're totally degenerate and totally insane. And I don't mean to impugn anybody, but unfortunately, that's what they are. And Gary Aldrich was horrified at these people. And so the whole Clinton spin allied to denounce Gary Aldrich, that he was really a secret Republican and that he was trying to destroy the Clinton administration. Whenever anybody criticizes Clinton, they call him a Clinton hater. In other words, if you find any fault with Clinton, you must be eaten up with envy and hatred of this wonderful person who's our president, you know. Yeah. And so Clinton hatred is supposed to be the big thing in the United States. But, well, he'll be long gone because, you see, the powers that be decided to get rid of him, and that's really what Greenspan has been doing. They want to get Clinton and Gore out and put in this very proper Republican administration again. It was the same deal that they did in 1980 with Reagan. They simply totally sabotaged Jimmy Carter. They put him on grease skids and ran him right out of Washington. And they're doing the same with Gore. Every reporter in the United States knows that Gore is gone, that he hasn't got the chance of a snowball in hell. And so it's Bush all the way. This is the way that they like unanimity. They like monolithic government. They don't want opposition. So they're going to get rid of Clinton and his gang of bums and put in a very sedate, a nice first lady who has never slept with anybody but her husband and the whole bit. We're going back to morals. Meanwhile, the same bankers will be running everything just as they did and doing everything they want. But at least Bush will not do what Reagan will do, what Reagan did. He brought in this bunch of socialists who called themselves conservatives, or neoconservatives. But Bush is bringing in the old CIA crowd. Remember, Bush Sr. was head of the CIA and was a CIA operative all of his life. It's the only job he ever had, really. He had these ships that were CIA passenger ships and everything else, supply ships. And, of course, they sabotaged the Bay of Pigs to ensure that Castro was about to fall in Cuba. He was gone. So they mounted an emergency rescue, the CIA mounted an emergency rescue operation to save Castro, called the Bay of Pigs. And, of course, all of Castro's opposition came out and fought him because they were assured that planes were coming from the United States and they would blow the Castro forces off the map. So when they went out and were fighting on the beaches, they looked up, there were no planes. No planes ever came. So, of course, Castro's opposition was totally wiped out, and he's been in power ever since. It was the same way that Bush did with Saddam Hussein in Iraq. They said, we've got to get rid of this new Hitler. Saddam is the new Hitler, we've got to get rid of him. So what happened? Saddam is still in power because he and Bush were partners in a number of enterprises. Saddam, by the way, is one of the wealthiest men in the world. I mean, he's a big player. And he helps keep the price of oil up. See, people are complaining about the price of gasoline. they don't realize that Saddam is doing that. Because if we had the Iraq production coming into this country, gas would be 25 cents a gallon. And so they can't have that. So they keep Saddam in power. And they did the same thing in Iraq. They got rid of all of Saddam's opposition, because when the United States attacked Iraq, then obviously every Iraq patriot had to support Saddam Hussein. So he's in for life. And that's the way things are done. You always support the opposition so you can control it. So we own Saddam Hussein. He is not a monster that the press claims. And we support Castro. We've kept Castro in power for 40 years. And this is the way they operate. Well, I mention this because the senior Bush, as head of the CIA, oversaw all these things. So what you're going to have under W, the new president, will be a CIA operation, which is the same as in Russia. You have the KGB running the state. Here we have, we'll have the CIA running things. And here again, the people, at some point, the people will have to make themselves recognized. And they're doing this through the Internet. The big question mark is the Internet. And that's why Washington has been making frantic efforts to control the Internet. So they did it through what they call child pornography. They set up sting operations where guys would try to recruit 12-year-old girls or 12-year-old boys for sex through the Internet. And, of course, this did happen, but it happened because it was a sting operation. There weren't thousands of people out there saying, gosh, I want to get some child sex through the Internet. It was all set up. And they wanted to use this to close down the Internet, to have total government control of the Internet. Well, unfortunately, it didn't work. Congress passed the law because when you have those $100,000 cash in envelope things, you know, your votes are very easy to get. And so they passed a law controlling the Internet, but the Supreme Court threw it out because it was totally unenforceable. And the Internet's going to continue to grow. And I think people are going to continue to assert themselves. And it's like Kathy said yesterday, we're at the beginning of the new revolution. Everything is opening up, and the people are going to have a chance to express themselves and to have government control. Because the criminals have exhausted all of their criminal operations. They have all the money, they have all the political power, and yet they're on the way out. Because time itself is against them. Information is against them. The wheel is turning around. And these people are going to be gone. I'm telling you, within 10 years, these banking people are going to be gone. My book came out in 1953, has been on the Federal Reserve, has sold over 1 million copies. There's been 8 complete plagiarized editions published by other people, and which was done to punish me, by the way. Said I didn't get any money from it, but it helped also to alert people to the Federal Reserve. So the information is out there. It's on its way. And what we have to look forward to, if you think you've seen prosperity yet, you haven't seen nothing yet, because we're going all the way. We're going to full production, and the people are going to get the benefits of their own economy. And so I thank you, and I just wanted to bring you that message of cheer. And this is absolutely as true of Canada as it is in the United States. You know, the first person who brought me to Canada was Eileen Pressler. And I said to her, why is the Canadian dollar below the American dollar? They should be trading at par. She said, because the bankers manipulate it. By keeping the Canadian dollar down, they create all sorts of opportunities for speculation. And there's great business is going on between the United States and Canada because of the disparity in the currency. And everybody's making money, everybody's happy, and as I say, it's totally, from an economic point of view, it's totally insane that the Canadian dollar would be below the American dollar.
Well, but it's thought to buy up our country. Our country is almost gone.
Well, that's exactly right. They're creating opportunities for speculators, and that's what they're doing. But hopefully that will change too, because What we want is economic equity. We want fairness. We don't want government by criminals. And that's what we've got. These people are criminals. In my book, The Curse of Canaan, I trace it back 5,000 years. These people didn't start yesterday. They have perfected these techniques over thousands of years. They have family dynasties all over the world. And they're simply used to having their own way. But in the modern world, they're totally obsolete. They're totally archaic. And they've got to go, and they're going to go. Thank you. Now, we do have time for a couple of questions, and I welcome any questions, and I'll try to answer them. You know, the old technique was that you'd be asked a question in a public meeting, and you would say, I'm so glad you asked that question, and then they would proceed not to answer it. But I've never done that. I'll answer any question, and I'll be glad to entertain questions. Yes. Mullins, Eustace Mullins, M-U-L-L-I-N-S. People think it's an Irish name, but it's actually French. It's Moulin, which means Miller in French. And
you just squeeze the handle to adjust the height.
Yeah.
Squeeze it.
You made a compelling case for what happened to Lincoln and to Kennedy. Of course, Kennedy with Executive Order 11110, June 4, 63. Do you have anything to say or any confirming information on Garfield and McKinley? Was the same motive behind the assassination of those two presidents?
Well, the assassinations of Garfield and McKinley were done by the bankers because they were working to get this central bank set up, you see. They were planning for it. And both Garfield and McKinley totally objected to it. So they had to be gotten rid of. They were murdered simply because they were in the way of the central bank plan. And almost all of these things that happen because the bankers want them to. See, the average American citizen or Canadian citizen is not really out to assassinate anybody. They might not like a particular politician, but they're not going to assassinate it. The assassinations have to be carefully planned. There has to be a lot of money behind it. Now, what they did with Kennedy, they flew in a group of Sicilian killers from Marseille. They were the ones that actually carried out the assassination. But like I say, they had five teams there because this had to go forward, and they couldn't have any recrimination, and they wanted it to happen. So if one team didn't do it, the other team, and so the Sicilian did it. And they flew into Canada, by the way, to a safe house immediately after the assassination. They stayed here in Canada for 5 days. It's all been documented. And then they flew them back to Marseille. So that's how it was done.
Any comment on Robert Kennedy?
Robert Kennedy was a revenge killing by the mafia. And
I'm sorry, Eustace?
Oh, Robert Kennedy was a revenge killing by the mafia. He was no threat to them anymore because they'd killed his brother. In fact, the happiest moment of J. Edgar Hoover's life was when he picked up the phone and called Robert Kennedy and said, "Your brother has been killed," and he hung up. And Robert Kennedy was devastated by that. He never recovered because they really hated each other. Actually, Robert Kennedy hated homosexuals first place, and he simply considered that J. Edgar Hoover, as head of the FBI, was totally subordinate to the Attorney General. Well, all the previous Attorney Generals had allowed J. Edgar Hoover to do whatever he wanted to because they were pretty much afraid of him. Kennedy was the first person that ever opposed him. And Kennedy, by the way, was murdered in the Ambassador Hotel. Now, the Rony Plaza Hotel in Miami Beach was the winter headquarters of the Mafia, and that's where J. Edgar Hoover and Clyde Tolson spent their winter vacations. So, but Robert Kennedy was murdered in the Ambassador Hotel, which was also a Shine hotel, a mafia hotel. See, the mafia recruited a guy named J. Meyer Shine, to handle their real estate interests, mostly movies and hotels. And so with the mafia money, J. Meyer Shine built these lavish hotels and movie theaters around the United States, which are all mafia stuff. And so when Robert Kennedy went to the Ambassador Hotel, he had no idea he was walking into the hands of the enemy. I'm sure he had no idea that there was a mafia hotel. And because Robert Kennedy was a different person from myself. We worked together on the McCarthy Committee, by the way. But Robert Kennedy, with all of his money and influence, he had other people do things. Well, I never had anybody do anything. If I wanted to do anything, I had to go and research it myself. The result was all of my information was firsthand. Everything Robert Kennedy got was filtered to him. And as I say, when he went to the Ambassador Hotel, he had no idea he was walking into his own assassination. I would have known that. I would have known it was a Shine Hotel. And Shine, by the way, his son David, was the Shine-Cohn partnership which sabotaged McCarthy's fight against the communists. McCarthy let me go in order to hire Cohn and Shine. So I have a personal memoir of that.
Well, first, Eustace, thanks so much for accepting Wes's invitation to bring your experience to Canada. What's your take on JFK's Jr.? Was that just a Washington airplane he was using, like a Washington heart attack?
JFK made a fatal mistake. First of all, he was a very dangerous person because he was the most famous celebrity in the United States. Second, he had $150 million of his own. Third, he had his own national magazine. This makes you an extremely dangerous person. And fourth, he had decided to do an all-out expose of Mossad and the Anti-Defamation League as the most dangerous influence in American politics. Well, when you go embark on a program like that, you're going to develop some engine trouble.
Second question.
You talked about Rothschild basically financing the buying of the Jewish homeland, but my understanding is Rothschild is not actually Jewish to begin with himself at all. Is it the original dynasty isn't Jewish, is it?
Well, the original dynastic name was Bauer, which means peasant in German. But as far as I know, the Rothschild family has always been Jewish as far back as I can find out. Even when they were Bauers, they were Jews and they were in the money business. See, the Jewish people during the Middle Ages were mostly in the rag merchant business. They dealt in secondhand clothes, and then they went into other businesses, but they always wound up in the money business because they were the advantage they had was they were international, just like the five Rothschild brothers set up in the five capitals of Europe. And by that means, we could control the whole European area.
I guess we wouldn't mind being peasants as well, then. But it's funny when you talk about, you know, we talk about Bill Gates being the richest man in the world. It's funny how when they always do those lists, there's never any bankings on the list.
No, that's forbidden. Forbes and all these people know they can't put any of those people on the lists, and they never appear on the lists.
Yeah, so I was just wondering, with the royalty of England originally coming from Germany, why was Hitler so able to launch such an attack against England and coming quite close to finishing it off?
Well, it's called international finance. You say the royal family of England owned half of the Ethel patents and all of the German planes, which were bombing London, the royal family of England was getting royalties on the gasoline they were burning. So it's just a matter of business.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mullins, for coming. I want you to speak a little bit on vaccinations, because that's been a big issue in my life for over 20 years. And number two, did you know Ayn Rand? And you probably did. And what kind of lady was she, really?
Well, Ayn Rand was the disciple of a new conservatism, and Alan Greenspan, who's now chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, was one of her principal pupils. And she believed in an enlightened selfishness, which in itself is fine. And but she was very influential. She's sort of the patron saint of the National Review, which is the organ of neoconservatism in the United States, the Bill Buckley organization. And Bill Buckley, of course, was a CIA operative all his life. And the National Review is a CIA paper. And its gods are Gene Kirkpatrick and Milton Friedman and Ayn Rand. And so none of these people have anything to offer in the way of truth or justice. And in fact, people like myself are considered a non-person by the National Review. Bill Buckley and I started out at the same time, but with Bill Buckley's CIA backing, he got national publicity and I got none. So that's the way it goes.
What about vaccination?
Oh, vaccinations, I have a chapter on that in my Murder by Injection book. And vaccinations are probably the most toxic substance you can introduce into the human body. Plus, they're deliberately engineered that the immune system cannot fight them, cannot expel them. And so they stay in your system throughout your life. And I quote medical authorities who say that every vaccination is a time bomb in the human system, which at some point, maybe 25, even 50 years, is going to erupt in a stroke, heart attack, or other or cancer. So you're carrying this. If you've been vaccinated, you carry this time bomb in your system, and you don't know when it's going to blow up, and you're going to fall over with a stroke or heart attack.
What is their purpose?
The purpose there, I think, is to ensure a lifetime of poor health and constant consumption of drugs and medications. Because after all, if the Rockefellers, they control every major drug company, they want to see the business coming in, you know. You want that bottom line and you want that those growth figures for the next 10 years. So it's all planned, and it's deliberately planned. Everything that they do, and including vaccination, is planned to attack the immune system and make you incapable of ever seeing good health again in your lifetime.
Thank you for your truth.
Surely.
Would you comment on the Norfed dollar, if you know about it, and other monies that's being printed that's backed by gold and silver in the States?
Yes, I'm familiar with the Norfed operation. In fact, I'm a member of it, and it's a way out. But until we get control of our own currency, Norfed itself is a very small operation. And what we simply need is to go into the Federal Reserve System and arrest everybody. I had a friend who did that, by the way. He went into the Federal Reserve Building on Constitution Avenue, the Marble Palace, and he was going to arrest the members of the Federal Reserve Board, which is the only thing to do because conspiracy to rob people is a definitely statutory offense. And that's what they do there. They rob everybody through these planned... I have a lot of material here on the Greenspan and the fact that his so-called fight against inflation is total is considered total nonsense by every economic writer in the world.
Any more questions? Oh, here we go.
I knew you had to get here sooner or later.
You mentioned that the Zionists were said that they believed that you could not have a state of Israel until the coming of the Messiah.
No, that was the Orthodox Jews. That's Orthodox Judaism. The Zionists came up with a alternative on the Reform Judaism that you could go ahead and have a Jewish state without the Messiah coming.
So the Zionists believe that you can have a Israeli state then.
Oh, yes, and they did. That's how they achieved it, because until... they came along with this alternative plan, the Jewish community of the world would never accept a Jewish state without the Messiah.
So that must have been bought and paid for by...
Oh, the Rothschilds put every penny into into Palestine. They sent the settlers out there. They paid all of their expenses, bought the land for them, set up great operations, wineries, and agricultural things. All that was Rothschild money.
And all the controversy right now going on in there between the Palestinians, you know, that's just got to be a big banking operation, it seems to me, connected with
oil.
Oh, very much
so. If you go to the State of Israel, you'll see the main street is called Rothschild Boulevard. The entire Israeli parliament was donated by Jacob Rothschild of London. In other words, imagine if a private American donated the entire building of the United States. And that's what happened in Israel. It's all donated by the Rothschilds.
Eustace, first of all, congratulations on all your outstanding work you've done through the years. I've known and heard of you for a number of years myself. I've been in the issue myself for some 20 years. But back in 1950, I have information I haven't been able to confirm it yet. Maybe you can help me. That the Senate Intelligence Committee put out a 3 or 4 volume report which listed all the communists in America and all their affiliations. Delano Roosevelt was in there, supposedly. I don't know how many lists of organizations she belonged to. And when LBJ came into office, the word I have is that he ordered that all of them be destroyed. And I understand there are 7 or 8 of them that have not been destroyed. Do you have any idea where I might be able to find one of those?
I really do not, because, of course, when they order those books destroyed, they're pretty thorough. Now, I do know that in the Army and Department of State, now whether it's under Truman or not, I'm not sure, all files concerning communist affiliation of government employees were destroyed. The whole Army was totally cleaned out. And in fact, when I knew Joe McCarthy, he still depended on the FBI for a lot of information. Bob Serene was the main person who was bringing him information. And they fired Bob Serene later on, too, unfortunately. But, McCarthy's information came from the FBI.
I'm aware of that. And liaison from, I was in the FBI 27 years, by the way. And the second question I'd like to ask you is, I've contended, having no documentation, of course, that the downfall of the wall in Berlin and the downfall of communism was all a facade in order for us to weaken our defenses and cut back and take over the country, Canada and the United States, from within. How do you feel about that?
Oh, that's absolutely true. There was a Soviet defector named Galinsky. You may know his book. And Galinsky outlined all this in detail about 15 or 20 years ago. And Galinsky's book is hard to find, but it's all in there.
Excuse me, go ahead.
Sure.
Isn't Galinsky the defected general who said that Clinton was in Moscow for 3 years during his youth and was being trained by the KGB?
Oh, yes. Clinton had advanced training in Moscow.
Was that Galinsky's book?
I'm not sure if it's Galinsky's or not, but there are other sources on that. There's no question about it.
Right.
Clinton, well, now some people claim that Clinton was actually a CIA operative, which is possible too, you know, because you know yourself, you have double agents, triple agents, quadruple agents. And so we all have this idea that a person can only work for one group at a time. In fact, a guy who has ability, everybody wants him, and they don't care if he's a double or triple agent, they want him on their side. So a lot of these people work for 4 or 5 different outfits.
Okay, thank you very much.
Surely.
Good morning. I've studied John Nelson's work. Are you familiar with John?
John Nelson?
John Nelson.
In Colorado?
Yes.
Oh, yes. I've been a correspondent.
One of the things that he really hammered home and in some of his information is that you cannot contract with yourself. In all notes, legal tender, have 2 signatures on it representing the government, of which if you can't contract with yourself, one of them's not of local properties. Therefore, all dollars are really international obligations. And when going into court, therefore, in a tax issue, you should be pleading international law because what they're collecting from you is an international obligation. Would you concur with that theory?
Well, obligations are contractual, and they're covered by the law. And the only thing you can do to protect yourself is uphold your contractual obligations and hope that the other side upholds them. And this is where legal ability comes in, because if they don't uphold their contractual obligations, then you have the ability to sue them. But there again, it's an adversary situation, and what it comes down to is your individual responsibility to defend your own interests. And you cannot defend your own interests by going out and hiring a lawyer or by going into a court and expecting justice. because any judge in the states and probably Canada also, as Ernest Zundel can tell you, you go into a court looking for justice, the judges laugh their heads off. They know it doesn't exist.
I'd just like to know what you feel about that Columbine massacre that happened there a couple of years ago.
In the schools there? Well, the whole Columbine episode was part of Clinton's gun control operation. And the two alleged students who did this, we don't know whether they did or not. We don't know if they were fired a shot, as a matter of fact. But they were on very strong medication. And with that kind of medication, you get hallucinations, delusions, and you also come under mind control. I'm sure Kathy could tell you a lot about that. So if they did what they did it because they were under mind control, because teenagers normally do not shoot their fellow students, nor do they commit suicide. But you see, under mind control, once you have carried out the operation, then you are instructed to commit suicide. So that it must have been a standard mind control operation.
Eustace, I hate to monopolize the questions, but I'm going to give you one more question.
Surely.
And an observation. I noticed in these school shootings and church shootings, I've contended all along it was CIA mind control in most instances.
Oh, yes.
In order to pass the legislation that would do away with the Second Amendment, right to bear arms. I noticed the newspaper articles the first day or maybe a day and a half after the shootings, where they go in and search the homes of the shooters, in about half of them, the newspapers reported they found satanic drawings in the homes.
Oh, yeah.
So, and I've been involved in, you know, investigating Satanism for a number of years, and I contend that these shootings are not only CIA mind control, but dovetails into the satanic movement itself. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, definitely. In fact, many adolescents are taken by these games like Guns and Dragons and all this sort of stuff. So there's a lot of that. It appeals to the adolescent mind, this sort of stuff, because it's costumes and rituals and excitement and different from the mundane world that they live in. So they're very susceptible to this. And once they get into it, then they're drawn into rituals and drugs and so forth. And some of them are already on drugs anyway. So they're simply being manipulated because adolescents are very easy to manipulate, because they're inexperienced and they're responsive to adults, and so they're easy to control.
Okay, last one. No problem.
Okay. What's your view on the Masonic movement?
Well, I've written about that extensively in my book, The Curse of Canaan, and I trace it back 5,000 years to the original Babylon and to Nimrod. Nimrod was the first Masonic ruler of the world, and he ruled by total evil. And of course, they had their satanic rituals, and they had human sacrifice. You name it, they had it. And that's been more continuous throughout history. As I point out in the Curse of Canaan, they periodically have to go underground because their crimes are exposed, and so they go underground and disappear and reappear as something else a couple of hundred years later. You have to have a long time frame in order to study these things, because, as I say, these movements may totally disappear for 300 years and then they appear in another country in a total different guise. So you just have to watch for the telltale signs, what they do and what kind of people are doing it. And so it's a matter of observation and experience. You have to know what to look for. It's like any investigative work. If you don't know what you're looking for, it's not going to come up and hit you in the head. You got to go find it.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we do have to wrap up. Tape time, I think, is probably coming to an end, and we have to get on with the rest of the speakers. So, Eustace Lawrence, thank you very, very much.
Disagree with anything you label racist. Welcome to the place. Welcome. Republic Broadcasting Network.